The name of the workshop is The Politics of Obedience, Breaking the Habit of Voluntary Servitude. And that's what the press conference outside was about, too. They're breaking that habit. This is good Brian Wilson right here. He served 4 years as an Air Force officer, including a stint in Vietnam in the Mekong Delta. He headed up a 40-man security team. Mr. Wilson possesses a Juris Doctor Master degree in criminology, corrections, and 2 honorary degrees in humanities and law, respectively. Good Brian Wilson.
I like probably some of you, was attending the press conference outside where the resistor was turning himself in. And I didn't want to leave because I was so affected by the presence of he and other resistors and how it was affecting me and almost flashing me back psychically to 1969, when I began my first experiences of resisting authority when I was an Air Force officer. That was even before I went to Vietnam. I was in what was called a new Air Force Ranger training unit. I didn't even know the Air Force had a Ranger unit. And I did not want to be in that unit. And an experience happened during that 12 weeks of training, during the bayonet exercise. I could not extend my arms with the M16 and the bayonet on the end into the dummy and shout, "Kill." That was not premeditated. I just couldn't. My body didn't want to do that motion and shout, "Kill." I had no idea that was going to happen to me until the moment it happened to me. It was the first evidence I had that there was some other part of me that there was another dimension of my being that I was not in touch with until that moment. And that began a process in my own mind of wondering why it was so easy for me to have followed an order to travel almost 10,000 miles to a country I knew nothing about, Vietnam, from my own farming village in upstate New York, to participate in destroying a set of villages in Vinh Long province in the Mekong Delta. Why was it so easy for me and thousands of others then and for generations prior to my time to follow orders, to be so obedient, to do things that were so criminal and so illogical and so unnatural? So a lot of my post-Vietnam life has been searching an answer to this question. I know how easy it is to be, that we're brainwashed and we're culturally conditioned. Our thought structures are very patterned around the mores of our culture. I understand that, but it was never satisfactory to me. I wanted to know where my soul was. I wanted to know where the real Brian Wilson was. And it just, I might have to go back and say that even though I never did that bayonet training, I completed all the rest of the training and I went to Vietnam. Even though I didn't want to go at that time, I went and I did the best job I could. But while I was in Vietnam, I witnessed in one 6-day period the bombings of 5 villages, in which these were inhabited fishing villages, in which somewhere between 700 and 900 Vietnamese were murdered. From which I have never fully recovered from that experience, both in terms of the trauma of witnessing the after effects of the bombings within 15 to 30 minutes after the bombings, And at the same time, it also created an epiphany in which I could see in the faces of the Vietnamese myself, and that we are all one. And it was, again, this resistor who's turning himself in understands this after he went through interrogator's training, went to Iraq as an interrogator, and witnessed what he witnessed, and realizing, what are we doing? And then the question comes back, what am I doing? What am I doing? Where am I in this picture? So I have been exploring this question of why it is we are so obedient to authority. Why are we so obedient to what we have been taught when our own experiences begin telling us there is some big gap between what we've been taught and what we're experiencing in terms of what seems right for us? And I got the title for this workshop from this book that was written, the essay that was originally written in 1553, called The Politics of Obedience, A Discourse on Voluntary Servitude. This obviously is an essay that has now been published in English. It was originally written in French by a French law student, De La Boete, when he was 23 years old in 1553. The Politics of Obedience. I thought, well, that is really an interesting question and an interesting subject. Why have I been so obedient to do things that were so insane and so criminal once I was able to get a handle on myself and the context in which I grew up in? So I know it's very easy for us to be obedient because, in a sense, the whole species has been very obedient to vertical authority structures since we had the advent of civilization some 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. When the advent of civilization came concentration of power, stratification of classes, secrecy, sacrifice, whether it's honest or whether it's direct or disguised. We are sacrificing all the time in our wars. People are sacrificed. It's justified. But we've always had sacrifice as part of vertical authority structures, whether they're kings through inheritance, whether they're dictators through armed overthrows. And this little device that is on me has a battery that fell out of it, and I don't know quite how it works. You got to put it.
Oh, okay. I'll put it down there.
So this person that wrote this book said it doesn't matter whether the authority structure is by inheritance, by arms, dictators, or by elections. That basically all groups that grew out of the civilization model, what we call civilization, rule by tyranny, one way or the other. Some use propaganda and thought control techniques. Some use fear and a combination of fear and propaganda, but in effect, no power structure remains in power without the consent of the vast majority of the people. And so I would like to submit that the term representative democracy is simply a disguise for oligarchy and plutocracy, and that we have all been complicit since the 1600s. In participating in a series of a development of a political structure that began with the colonies that were, for the most part, theocracies, to the Constitutional Convention, which was held in secrecy by an oligarchy, and Jefferson's term was an empire of liberty, Madison's term was imperial republicanism. The fact is that we are still living in a society ruled essentially by white male supremacists with various disguises that we've all believed in, thinking we were living in. I certainly thought I was living in the greatest country in the history of the world, endowed by God to go all around the world to bring prosperity in Christianity. It was a great story. It is a phenomenal story. It's so phenomenal that, of course, it's just a lie and untrue. But it's a myth. And the degree to which we believe in that myth is the degree to which we do not resist and begin to re-examine an alternative way to identify our social structures. And in my readings of anthropological history, I realized that most all human beings, up until about 5,000 years ago, when we had the advent of civilization, lived in small tribal units where everything was familiar. Familiarity with each other, familiarity with the land. And our nervous system and brains developed around familiarity. And that once we started having what we call representative democracy, what the Zapatistas call a fraud, saying that democracy has to be direct, and only in small groups can it really work. We keep thinking that we live in a democratic society which has never in fact been democratic. But we've also lived in two other blips in history besides the vertical authority model, which we live in this society as well. We have a vertical authority structure, and we have what we call representatives that supposedly represent us, but they represent money, and it's really always been that way. But two other blips we grew up in. The oil blip, the Industrial Revolution and the oil blip, which in a very short period of time created a whole new value system around speed, volume, lack of concern about consequences of our technology and our choices with that technology. And so we've grown up in a blip that is about to end, or is on the end game side. So we have developed habits, work habits, life habits, thought habits, all determined, mostly determined by what oil has enabled us to do. Oil that formed, it took 180 million years to form in the earth, and 120 years, half of it's now in the air. And as demand for oil goes up and the supply of oil goes down, we're at the end of this oil blip. The third blip we grew up in was the middle class blip, post-World War II. There was never a significant sized middle class in this society until post-World War II. And so we grew up, if we grew up in this middle class, or in my case, a lower working class family that was aspiring to be middle class, there were certain values that determined the conversation in our home, that determined the church we went to, how we were taught in Sunday school and in our public schools. And that middle class began to deteriorate during the Reagan years. But in those golden years, post-World War II, most of us were shaped by those values that were in the larger blip of an oil-based society, which also is very short in human history. So we have lived in these three blips. I call them blips in the long view of human history. And now we're facing collapse of all the systems that we've grown up with. Transportation systems, economic systems, political systems, social systems. They are all in the stage of early collapse or middle collapse. And yet, we as a species predate nation states, capitalism, and we have some archetypal human characteristics such as empathy and equity, which are equally as strong, if not stronger, than tendencies toward aggression, violence, and competition. This is debated among anthropologists, but nonetheless, as a Jungian myself, or one who studies Jung, I love the concept of the archetypes, two of which, equity and empathy, we cannot live without. We absolutely cannot live without empathy and equity. We can't live without food, water, and air, but we also cannot live without empathy. That means understanding our sacred relationships with everything and everybody, and we can't live without equity, which is a product of empathy, basically justice, mutual respect, fairness. And we can see in the Bush administration, in my opinion, a cosmic gift that has been presented to us that we could not recognize if a Democrat was in power. What Bush's administration has done is made the history of this imperial society real and evident for everybody to see. It's been that way all along, and this is just the ultimate policies that are required to maintain a way of life for 4.5% of the world's population that consume anywhere from a quarter to nearly half the world's resources. It's nothing other than a policy that is driven by and required by the collective American way of life, which is way out of whack from reality, and yet we all grew up believing it was a good place to grow up, and that the values were solid and were sustainable. Now we have this incredible opportunity to look at the politics of our obedience, which perhaps now requires us to become massively disobedient. At least disobedient to the model and the values we grew up with, if we want to survive. We also have to deal with the three Holocausts that formed this nation. Holocaust number one was stealing the land at gunpoint, killing the original inhabitants, or assimilating the original inhabitants, either intentionally or even without premeditating the death of all the Indians through diseases brought by the Europeans, but nonetheless celebrated by the Europeans when the Indians died of smallpox. We have done that with total impunity. We have never had to pay anything emotionally, politically, or financially for the theft of our original sin of taking the land from inhabitants who had been here for at least 10,000 years. The second Holocaust was the theft of labor, which enhanced all of the European powers to colonize most of the earth through slave labor. Africa lost somewhere between 35 and 50 million of its inhabitants over a 300-year period to slavery. We have never, ever had to pay real reparations we have never really addressed in this deep sense the fact that every African that came to the Western Hemisphere was disrupted from his or her family and tribes that had existed for thousands of years. Were disrupted just like that. Imagine how that would affect persons for centuries. And that was done with impunity. And then in the 20th century, we used our military to go to more than 100 countries to get whatever resources, markets, and labor we needed to facilitate our continued prosperity as a nation that no longer could domestically consume the production agriculturally and industrially that was coming out of this nation. So we had to go elsewhere to find markets in order to keep the profits sustained. So we had the American century, the century of imperialism. Noam Chomsky said, what ruled the 20th century was the fifth freedom. Not the four freedoms that Roosevelt talked about, freedom of want, freedom from want, freedom from fear, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. He said those freedoms don't really gather our attention. The freedom that gathers our attention is the freedom to rob and pillage and murder when people are in the way of our continued expansion for prosperity. And when that happens, we send in the Marines. We take it seriously when that freedom is abridged. And we've all, living in this society, have been complicit in participating in a corporate society, in an oligarchic society. We elect these representatives, we pay our taxes, we buy these products. We all are caught in this very intense web of entanglement that produces what we call the United States of America, or the United Corporate States of America, or the United States of Amnesia, whatever. So this is a moment, a critical moment in history, that provides us an opportunity to be able to see, with global warming, peak oil, the Bush administration, that basically all of our systems that we have been dependent upon, all of them, are in a state of collapse, because they have never really been based on anything that was very authentic in the first place. We have never had to think about sustainability in the Industrial Revolution period. There was no such thing as unsustainability prior to civilization. Life was in a state of stasis. And so here we are, facing the hottest year on record, which we now know is a result of our collective use of electricity, driving cars, flying planes, heating our homes, all these things that are essential for our lives, we think. And we know we're going to be running out of oil at some point in the near future, whether it's 10 years or 50 years, it doesn't matter. When the pipeline is closed in Alaska, everybody freaks out because we are at the mercy of this finite resource and these corporations that are, yes, making lots of money, but they're making money because we're dependent upon their products. We are addicts. We have become addicted to a way of life that is not sustainable. That's the essence of the problem as I see it. We all, myself included, have become addicted to a way of life that we think is our right. But remember, 500 years now we've been in this period of colonization where 20% of the world's population impoverished 80%, or thrived off impoverishing 80%. A very bad karmic situation. An unfair situation. A situation rooted in racism. Rooted in a sense of superiority. Rooted in what I thought was taught in my Sunday school as the exceptional society. We are an exceptional society. This was taught to me in my Baptist Sunday school. And we have an obligation to bring God's will to the whole planet. Imagine that. So we have an opportunity now for the real revolution. And some of us cycle to the convention. I hand cycle to the convention. And it wasn't just for recreation, although it was a phenomenal experience. It was because we wanted to demonstrate a new commitment to start changing our addictions by thinking about the consequences of every action we take. Every day we buy clothes, or we buy food, or we move ourselves from point A to point B, often by just using a key that goes in an ignition switch, and we go off in a 3,000-pound vehicle to get a few pounds of groceries. This is all crazy. But we've grown up not even thinking of it. It's just been normal. So this is a time for us to really, really, really understand that our humanity goes back, even empathy, they have discovered, is pre-hominid in our earlier ancestors. Pre-hominid. That empathy, caring for one another. This is an very ancient archetype. So it is inside of each of us. And as we begin to understand the consequences of our actions, the consequences of every purchase, the consequences of every drive, we can begin to understand, we may begin to feel, actually, the pain that is caused or inflicted on others, because we haven't known this. And I wouldn't have known it if I hadn't seen 700 to 900 Vietnamese lying in 5 villages, people who had never left their village and were just farmers. What was I doing 10,000 miles from my farm in upstate New York? I mean, it's a staggering thing that we've been doing this for centuries and not thinking about how insane it is, and where was my soul? Where is our soul? And so we're capable of radical leaps. We're capable of doing whatever we need to do to survive. And if we want to survive, we really have to begin thinking about local communities and not nation states. We have to start re-examining where our social network can be interacted with at a personal level, where we can see each other. This is called tribal, local steady state economies, if you will, and almost an indigenous model that can federate with all the other communities around the world, but isn't ruled by a hierarchical, bureaucratic state authority figure. Now, this is a leap. This is a consciousness, a matter of consciousness. And we are totally capable of doing it. Cycling here, and 2 of the cycles or 3 of the cycles are still over there by the display of the photos of the cycling, used no fuel, although we did have support wagons to see if we could actually pull this off. The support vehicles ran on biodiesel, which is a step, not a solution, but a step in a reduced use of petroleum. Actually, biodiesel uses no petroleum. But it does require the use of growing plants and harvesting the plants for oil, for vegetable oil. So by cycling here, we wanted to not use petroleum, and we wanted not to pollute the air. And so I figured out that we actually cycled 386 miles from Eugene to the University of Washington. So somebody asked me today whether I'd be willing to cycle to Washington next year for a May Day, a big May Day rally. And I said, yes, I'd be willing to cycle to Washington if there was a support network that enabled us to travel that 3,000 miles. That will take me 100 days. But I would be happy to spend 100 days cycling across the country to say that I want to go from point A to point B without using petroleum. And believe me, you meet a lot of people along the way. And you interact with people. And some of them are right here that greeted us in Corvallis. And it's a new way of expressing your real humanity. You're kind of stripping away all the defense mechanisms that we've developed to avoid us feeling anxious, that comes from feeling in stratification and class produces anxiety, and anxiety is almost impossible to live with. So most of us find ways to avoid feeling the anxiety by creating defense mechanisms. Almost, you know, they're addictions. Buying things, sexism, racism, nationalism, patriotism. These are all just defense mechanisms that keep us from feeling our real self and feeling comfortable about ourselves. Because we haven't been feeling comfortable about ourselves for 5 or 6,000 years. That's 300 generations that have transmitted a basic sense of insecurity from one generation to another. Now we have an opportunity to recognize that what we have done is dug ourselves this huge hole from which we are capable, because we are human beings with archetypal human characteristics that predate all of these systems, to re-access and begin to experiment, like cycling to Seattle, which was our little experiment, to see what happens with your life, see what might change, how the ideas that are transmitted from one to another begin to motivate imaginations that we didn't have before. I'd like to stop there, and I was so affected by this press conference, I really almost couldn't deal with my thoughts for this workshop. Just a little anecdote before we have questions. I had my colonel boss in my ranger training school refused to do the bayonet drill, which I didn't intend to refuse to do. It was something had happened to my arms. My body didn't want to do it. I call that radical knowing. It wasn't cognitive. It was much deeper than my cognitive. It was my whole being that could not do this motion. He was so angry with me in his office the next day that he threw me onto the floor of his office with a major standing next to him, and then kicked me as I fell on the ground. I was a first lieutenant, and he was a lieutenant colonel, a very overweight lieutenant colonel who couldn't even do the exercises. And that was a that was a very harsh moment in my life. And he was shouting at me, "You should be ashamed! You should be ashamed! You should be ashamed for being this loyal." And I didn't even know what had happened to me. I was still processing. Even thought that if they gave me another chance to do the bayonet training, I could do it, because I was so determined to comply with the requirements of this training. And then he said, "You need morals training," and he sent me to the squadron chaplain. And I was in the chaplain's office the very next day, and the chaplain showed me some photographs of what looked like dead Vietnamese, and he said, "You have an obligation to stop this from continuing." And I was so upset, I threw the photograph on the floor, and I said, "I need counseling. I need to have a conversation about what's going on inside of me." And he said, "You are very disturbed." He said, "You should be ashamed of yourself." The same thing the colonel said. So I think that was a moment at which something really shifted in me, that I had to listen to my body. My body knew more than my brain. My body knew that plunging that bayonet in that body, in that dummy, there was something wrong about that. My brain wanted me to do it because my brain was conditioned to go along to get along. But my body was representing something far more ancient than that. So that's what I call radical knowing. And there's even a book about that called Radical Nature by Christian de Quincey, a philosopher. At any rate, we all have our our various chapters and maybe epiphanies. And certainly, if we haven't had major epiphanies prior to now, now is the time to be open to epiphanies as we face the end game of everything we have become dependent upon. As Richard Heinberg says in The Party's Over, and James Kunstler says in The Long Emergency, as David Corton says in The Great Turning, this is a time. This is a time for no more business as usual. This is a time for your imaginations to go really wild as to how we're going to break our addictions and begin living in community in a way that's sustainable for ourselves and therefore for the planet. Okay, I'm going to shut up and receive questions or comments or condemnations. Well, I was in a quiet room here. I was told to go to a quiet room to start thinking about this workshop when somebody came in and said, "Could you please clear out of this room? We have a resistor who's meeting with his lawyers right here as he's just about to do a press conference outside, turning himself in." And so I just basically left the room where I was going to prepare for this workshop and went outside with the resistor. And there was a crowd out there of several hundred people as this former interrogator in Iraq was turning himself in and talking about how what he witnessed after 4 months as an interrogator at Abu Ghraib, or there was another interrogator who spoke who was at Abu Ghraib for 8 months. I don't know whether this guy was at Abu Ghraib or not, but he was an interrogator in a prison or prisons in Iraq with Iraqis being the victims. And he was just talking from his heart about the fact that his conscience dictated to him that he could no longer participate. See, this is the easy part. For those of us who were in military and who had experiences that were so demonic that you had to go someplace inside to say, I can't do this. I can't do this. And he was basically saying, I can't do this anymore. And he was talking about how he was shamed by his superiors and others. And it was just taking me back to a place that's really kind of a beautiful place, but it's a very painful place. A beautiful place because you're reclaiming your power as a human being. No matter what the circumstances are, no matter what the penalties are going to be. But I was also remembering for the first time in a long time how I was thrown down on the floor and kicked in the ribs by my colonel, and him shouting at me, shame on you, shame on you, shame on you. And then realizing that as painful as that was the moment at which I began finding my, you know, real humanity. I want some counseling. I want to have a conversation. I don't know why I didn't do the bayoneting. And this guy was basically saying that, you know, I mean, I wish that I had the clarity he'd had before and even during my Vietnam stay. My clarity did come in Vietnam, but I was sent home early. But just to know that these people are resisting, and he's turning himself in today. He's been an AWOL for a year. And it just, this kind of courage and this kind of conviction is, it's just very emotional for me. It really moves me. It's awesome. It means, you know, this is what we all have this capacity to say, no, we're not participating anymore. David Corton, in his book, The Great Turning, talks about the most radical thing we can do is stop shopping. Stop supporting corporate products. You know, water. We are against privatizing water, and yet we buy bottled water, which is basically promoting privatization of water. In our packets for this convention, if you noticed, in your packets was an advertisement for Coke and the water that Coca-Cola sells, that under the code name of
Dasani.
I now have a Camel pack, so I go around drinking my water. If I can get this untangled. So this is what I wear when I'm cycling, but it also serves a good purpose when I'm going to be busy all day, when I want to have my regular water supply. It's right here. We are so caught up into this materialism. And I would submit that virtually everybody in this room is caught up in it to varying degrees, some more than others. And it's just a process of beginning to extricate ourselves from this complicity and reclaiming ourselves in a social unit that we can recognize as accountable. That is really local community. The Zapatistas say they have 1,000 autonomous communities in Chiapas. In 37 municipalities, and they have meetings every day in each community, and they communicate with each other through runners or people on horseback. They don't have cars, and it's somewhat similar to the Basque region in Spain prior to their being destroyed by Franco in the Spanish Civil War, where for 100 years the worker co-ops and the consumer co-ops communicated with each other in the Pyrenees region of northeast Spain and southwest France. They did not even honor the government of Spain. They did not consider themselves part of the government. I don't consider myself part of the government of the United States. I have to really be clear that my path is determined by something different from loyalty to a nation state. I'm not into patriotism. I'm not into nationalism. I'm a citizen of the planet trying to do what the butterfly does that's in this, coming out of this wheel that was a caterpillar that devours everything and then goes into its, what do they call it, the chrysalis, and then it flies thousands of miles and treads very lightly on the earth and cross-pollinates. So the bicycle wheel, to me, is a symbol of our liberation from petroleum and cars. A wheel was invented 8,000 years ago, and the butterfly coming out of the hub represents our metamorphosis from dependence on petroleum and cars to a commitment or an epiphany, if you will, to being sustainable, realizing that being sustainable requires mindfulness and consciousness. And so consciousness is basically that which we are have been, for the most part, lacking, because it hasn't been important in this society. Consciousness, being mindful of the consequences of every choice we make every day. The seventh generation that the Seneca Indians talked about. Well, the questions had to do about fasting, tax resistance, and the role of Nelson Mandela in moving a whole society. In Arcata, California, where I live, I'm on the Peak Oil Action Group. And one thing we're discussing is developing a 200-mile diet. It's a diet that would include food only grown and raised within 200 miles of Arcata. This is something we're just beginning to talk about. This would be one way to guide us in sustainability around food, and it's pretty shocking to discover how much we're dependent upon food that comes from 1,500 or 2,000 miles from our homes. I mean, this is just totally insane, but of course we haven't had to think about it. It's just something we take for granted. So just becoming conscious about eating food that you know where it is grown and how it is grown and how much energy has gone into moving it from where it was grown to where you're eating it. That would be not fasting, but it would be a conscious decision about changing eating habits, which, believe me, would be very radical. It's amazing how radical that is to go to a 200-mile diet. Tax resistance. I have been a tax resister since 1983. I have refused to pay any tax. It took me, however, 6 years of thinking about that before I had the courage to do it, because I myself did not want the IRS to get anything from me. So I finally had to resolve that I would live without property, without bank accounts, and that I was willing to go to prison, which I initially was not willing to do when I thought about tax resistance. So it took me about 6 years before I really started my tax resistance. And I know it would be exciting if 150 or 1,500 or 15 million people did tax resistance, but I have somehow not been able to wait for the 150 or the 1,500. So I would love it if 150,000 people became tax refusers. I did mine very openly. I told the IRS exactly what I was doing. I said, under the Nuremberg obligation, I'm obligated to not participate in the crimes of my government. And by paying the money, I'm complicit. And I know how much killing is going on. I had taken 20-some trips to Latin America and had extensively documented what was happening in Latin America. Plus, I had my Vietnam experiences. And I always made it clear to them that I was what they had to deal with, because I had no assets. And I filed honest tax returns of my self-employment income. So I really did push it. And my lawyers always said I needed to expect to do a grand jury term in prison. 18 months in prison. But in 1999, the statute of limitations expired, and they did not take me to prison. So I'm actually free of the IRS, and ironically, even a contradiction, after 1999, my income is tax-free from the VA, from the very government that I condemn. So it is a contradiction of sorts, but my VA is for post-traumatic stress disorder, which increasingly became severe in the 90s, and I actually voluntarily hospitalized myself in a non-VA hospital at one point before I was convinced, well, maybe you should consider the VA paying you back for the experiences you had that created this situation. But tax resistance is, to me, the most obvious form of withdrawing complicity with the government, but it really requires one to think through every aspect of their life. It actually caused my first divorce, my tax resistance. It's a very radical step because you have to look at everything in your life and really think about what is really important and what is not important. But I would love it if more people would think about that and decide the kind of changes that they needed to make to even reduce their taxable income. And the third thing about Nelson Mandela, of course, he spent 20-some years in prison for his belief in getting rid of apartheid. And Steve Biko, who was killed in a Johannesburg prison in 1978, he refused in the police station to identify other members of the ANC to the police. And he said, "You do not own my mind, you do not own my body, you do not own my cooperation." And they killed him. But he had dignity, and that his experience still is a motivator for me. Because as my Nicaraguan mother said, who had no education at all, I have a Nicaraguan mother who adopted me, said, "Dignity trumps longevity. Dignity trumps longevity. Longevity is nothing without dignity." And it's a very Buddhist kind of a belief, but she was just a campesina woman in the mountain. I think that when Nelson Mandela became the president, if you look carefully at the policies of the South African government, you notice that at that point, Mandela did, in many ways, have to comply with the World Bank provisions in order to get money. And so I would argue that we need to begin envisioning our social units not at nation-state levels, but at community levels. Because at the nation-state level, the vertical authority structures are supported by corporate money, which is supported by us, really, by virtue of the way we live our lives and buy our products. So I think the revolution ultimately comes down to each of our choices, and then collectively how we're sharing our choices and actually sharing with one another instead of having to have money for everything. In Arcata, we now have Humboldt currency. I mean, it's not very advanced, but we're trying to create our own currency so that we can actually trade locally with people we know and barter. Really, I think it's back to Einstein's statement that imagination is more important than knowledge. You know, we're drowning in information, but we're lacking in imagination.